This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for December 2008. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. Each month on the Poetry Magazine podcast, we highlight a few poems in the upcoming issue. This month, we're going to hear from Fred Degar.
Our trick was to mouth words, sound as if we knew what we would one day come to know.
Joan Houlihan.
Then mask me the Gwyn, her skin being mine, and body that pools in the brine of her.
And from Roddy Lumsden.
You bastards, it's all sherbet, and folly makes you laugh like mules.
We're keeping the focus on poems this issue, but we also have our usual prose in the back, right, Don? Several interesting things this time.
Well, for one thing, we've got a print interview with Seamus Heaney, done by Dennis O'Driscoll, more like a conversation between them in print. And it's excerpted from a rather large book that was conducted, I guess, over a period of time in which Dennis O'Driscoll asked Seamus Heaney everything he could think of about his entire career.
Yeah, they were public, weren't they? Public interviews.
Yeah, so it's like a conversation, but it's good to have it sort of in front of your eyes so you can really see and think about what these guys are saying.
Anyone who's read poetry, a lot of poetry, comes across Seamus Heaney all the time. I think he accounts for 90% of the sales of contemporary poetry in England. That's not exactly a real number, actually.
Yeah,
I saw that in some survey. But he's still got new things to say. And what I was interested in, that we talk so much in this country about the dichotomy between avant-garde and mainstream poetry, and it exists in England too, though in a more muted form. And he says that the term avant-garde is an old-fashioned term by now, and he says that John Ashbery, uses Ashbery as an example. He was once avant-garde, but he's now the, you know, as mainstream as anybody. This is the grand old man of poetry. And he goes on and he says, there's a phrase I heard as a criticism of W.H. Auden, and I like the sound of it. Somebody said he didn't have the rooted normality of the major talent. He's drawing a distinction between sort of specialists, coterie poets, and the major talents. He says, I'm not sure the criticism applies to Auden, but the gist of it is generally worth considering. Even in Eliot, the big normal world comes flowing around you. Robert Lowell went head-on at the Times. There was no more literary poet around. But at the same time, he was like a great cement mixer. He just shoveled the world in and it delivered. Now, that's what I yearn for, the cement mixer rather than the chopstick.
Right.
It's that great Heaney'd language.
It is, really. I know people think of Heaney as being oracular because he is oracular. But actually, there's some fine distinctions in there that are very generous. It's the kind of generosity of spirit you want in a poet and you want in a reader of poetry. He's read everything. He's taking certain sides for his own purposes. He's not telling people what to do, and he's not standing for any particular school of poetry or being for or against the canon. He's sort of stepping outside of all these things, and it's still very lively. You know, he's not looking back over a long career, though he does remember how he started out. And one of the things I like in this interview is when he talked about starting out as a young poet, and he says that one of the difficulties a poet has is to know, he says, whether a little quick flash of lyric is sufficient. You have the invitation and the inspiration, for want of a better word, but the question that I can never answer is this: to what extent the will should do the work of the imagination? As Yeats said, how far you should push a thing. And then he says, when you're starting out as a young poet, you love the high of finishing. So you do the lyric quickly, and that's a joy. As you go on, the joy of actually doing it, of beating the gold out further, of making more of it, of wondering, can I take it further, is what you ideally want. But then the doubt comes in. Am I killing it? Am I deadening it?
Yeah, that's a great description. It's like Eliot getting inside the process. He's so good at that.
Yeah, so, you know, maybe in an age when wisdom is only seen to be received, in Heaney's case, wisdom has been earned, and I think readers will benefit from seeing this questioning of him and by him as he looks over his own process of working.
Yeah, and speaking of wisdom, there's another prose piece, an autobiographical essay by the experimental poet Fanny Howe. She's usually linked with experimental poets. And this piece is fascinating in a lot of ways. It came to you originally, right?
She's a terrific prose writer. We ran a little prose piece by her in our summer issue this last summer, where she remembers Edward Dahlberg chasing her around the desk with his pants down. But she is really capable of great and serious reflections, spiritual reflections, meditative things. So this is a nice notebook piece by her. One of two will be running.
Yeah, there's another one in March.
Another one coming in March, which really gets at the spiritual stuff. This one's more autobiography.
I love the way that she can move so seamlessly between that autobiography and criticism. It's the kind of prose you expect from a poet, but you don't find as often as maybe you would wish. Yeah. You know?
And the nice thing about this prose is that although she's a kind of moralist and stands for things, it's deeply meditative, and so that allows us to be able to make our own connections as we read it ourselves. She's not telling us what to think, even though she stands for certain kinds of things.
Yeah, listen, there's a linchpin to this. The piece sort of hinges on one entry in this notebook, and she talks about the French philosopher Simone Weil, who said one must believe in the reality of time, otherwise one is just dreaming. For years I have recognized this flaw in myself, the importance that it represents, and yet I have done nothing to get rid of it. And Fanny Howe contradicts this. She says, to resist the reality of time is to resist leaving childhood behind. They call this resistance a flaw in herself, but is it? The self is not the soul, and it is the soul, or coherence, that lives for 9 years on earth in a potential state of liberty and harmony. Its openness to metamorphosis is usually sealed up during those early years until the self replaces the soul as the fist of survival.
That's really terrific.
That is terrific, yeah. We have such an ingrained notion in this country of developing the self, and the self is the thing that you value. And she's sort of undercutting that absolutely and saying that we've lost the notion of a soul, that the self, in fact, is actually secondary to that.
Well, she's talking about the formation of our relationship to the world and tracing that back in her own life. And although I think she is thought of as an experimental poet, there's an interesting connection you can make here when she remembers her grandfather's library. Her grandfather was a widower and portly. She calls him very white, mild of manner, but he had a lot of books lying around. And Fanny says, a bakery smell of books lingered around his bookshelves. And she describes what was there. She's a little kid, and she sees these books that are for children in his library. And she says they were not ordinary American fare. She says these were Victorian storybooks, including pictures of curly-haired children in pinafores, stonewalls, gollywogs, leaping figures with scissors following them to cut off their thumbs, and gardens containing pale but specific flowers. And then she says, the reality is they were turn of the century, and the aura of this time was so strong, it affected everything I did and thought about later. So in a funny way, here's an experimental poet who's saying she has roots in the Victorian era.
Yeah, it makes you jealous of a childhood like that. Mine
really
was not
does.
Like that. She has another piece where she talks about, you know, going to Paris for a weekend to meet a family friend and being shown around, and the family friend was Samuel Beckett.
Yeah.
So it's not the kind of childhood I had.
No, and she had a nice love affair with Liam Clancy from the Clancy Brothers that she talks about at the end of this piece, too. Just an amazing life, and it continues, and she's just a terrific prose writer. I think people really like this piece.
Fred Degas appears for the first time in the magazine with two poems about his childhood in Guyana.
Guyana's been in the news again a little bit recently, as people remember what happened with Jim Jones. But interestingly, it's the only country in South America that's part of the Commonwealth of Nations. And so culturally, it's closer to English-speaking Caribbean countries like Trinidad and Tobago than it is to neighboring Venezuela and Suriname.
My parents are Guyanese, and they went to the UK, and I was born in London. And then they went back to Guyana, where I had 10 years as a child, and then back to London again.
Fred Degas now teaches in the U.S. at Virginia Tech. The poem we're about to hear is called R-O-Y-G-B-I-V, which is an acronym for the colors of the rainbow. You remember that? It's red, orange, yellow, green. I should have looked this up. Blue.
It didn't work.
What's the I? What's the I?
Indigo.
Indigo and violet, right.
Yes, Roy G. Biv, as we remember from our school days.
But in Guyana, we had a British colonial mnemonic which said Richard of York, gain battles in vain.
The poem we're about to hear by Fred Degas is set in a rural Guyanese school.
R-O-Y-G-B-I-V. The shoemaker's wife ran preschool with a fist made not so much of iron, but wire bristles on a wooden brush. She made us recite and learn by rote. Our trick was to mouth words, sound as if we knew what we would one day come to know, what would dawn on us as sure as a centipede knows what to do with its myriad legs. She made us settle our feet on the mud floor of our daub and wattle hut, and she wielded a cane cut from wood that bit into the palm of the hand and left a burn that resonated up the arm for an age after its smart swing and crisp contact. Worst of all was the shoe cupboard, where the old man stored his wire brushes. A cold, dark, narrow place, replete with brushes hung on nails, covering every square inch, and said to come alive when a child was locked in with them, so that they scrubbed flesh off that child's bones. She said we would end up there if we did not concentrate. So we stilled our feet and spoke the words in the right order for colours in the rainbow, until the very thing took her place in front of us, arranged in cuneiform, polished, brandishing a window to climb out.
Well, where I came from, they had corporal punishment. We were paddled by our teachers. I remember I got paddled quite a bit by my spelling teacher, who was also a baseball coach in my school.
Yeah, and I remember getting hit on the palms with a cane thing.
Yes,
yeah.
And he talks about that in the poem, the cane cut from wood that bit into
the palm of the hand and left a burn that resonated up the arm for an age.
It's a real age contained in this poem, that era when you were sort of beaten into your cultural heritage.
Now, I wonder if that actually, you know, I don't remember that punishment actually doing me any good in terms of learning. He seems to suggest that it does here, actually, right? I mean,
Well, I guess if they threatened to lock you up in a cupboard with those wire brushes in there, that's a kind of a classroom, too, you know, shut you in there in a cold, dark, and narrow place.
There is an escape in this poem. Like, he's being forced to memorize the colors of the rainbow, and in doing that, he actually has this apparition where it becomes a rainbow and it releases him from the room. But you could argue that he wouldn't have memorized the colors of the rainbow without that punishment.
Well, yeah, it's a complicated thing, too, because part of the punishment is this colonial legacy. So what they're being taught is, he says, how to speak the words in the right order. And you can hear that kind of tension in this poem and the other poem that accompanies it in the issue, where he's got the heritage of English words in the right order that he's learned, but also it's inflected by sort of the local tradition that he imbibes.
Yeah,
and so he's born in London, grew up in Guyana, and that is a direct experience of how one is taught to say words in the right order, but has to work in between the lines, as it were, one's own identity.
So we stilled our feet and spoke the words in the right order for colors in the rainbow, until the very thing took her place in front of us, arranged in cuneiform, polished, brandishing a window to climb out.
It really sort of takes flight in an unexpected way right at the end with that word brandishing.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize how much you can get done with one verb, first of all.
Yeah, I mean, here's a guy and the cane has been brandished against him, and now there's a different kind of brandishing at the end, an escape, a window to climb out.
Yeah. Here's what Fred Degar had to say about the ending of this poem.
The idea is that this chant was enough to help us out in our fear of the cupboard and a way out of the room. And literacy is a kind of escape from tyranny.
Joan Houlihan is also new to the pages of poetry. She's the founding director of the Concord Poetry Center in Massachusetts and a teacher at Lesley University. And in this issue, we're publishing three poems from a book she'll publish next year called The Us.
The Us is a sequence of poems that tells the story of a primitive group of chronically nomadic people. And this group of nomads, called The Us, is not something out of history or anthropology, but something that just comes out of Joan Houlihan's imagination. And she does say, though, that there are Celtic echoes in this narrative.
One of the main characters is I, spelled A-Y, obviously a pun on the pronoun I, the personal pronoun. We're going to hear a poem spoken by this I.
And he's remembering the death of his mother, which took place earlier in the manuscript. This is his monologue around that death, remembering it and re-experiencing it.
So these poems occasionally use words from the nomad's language, neologisms. In this poem, there's the word Gwyn, which means wife. Here's Joan Houlihan reading, She Had a Death in Me.
She had a death in me, knees drawn up, and my bowl and cloth rinsed through with her. As morning takes night, field closes the hair, and I would burrow into her. Over the altar, catalpas rattle, shadow and bother the branch. Is this her white? Dress me. Her rain? Wash me with that. Her bowl? Feed me empty. Her colding? I am forgot. Then mask me the Gwyn, her skin being mine, and body that pools in the brine of her. Rivers the silt and stone of her, wrapped in the warm of her fell. She were the watcher and tender of pyres, when the wet grass shined with quiet, and I lean to the mouth hole, I, mother.
This makes me think of a comment from Seamus Heaney in that interview, actually, where he said if he comes across a difficult poem, that he listens to the score, tries to perceive what the score of it is, you know, so that he can pick up on that first. And this is a difficult poem, not by virtue of what it's saying exactly, but because the language is new and the syntax is confused. And so it leaves you sort of at sea at certain moments, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it invites you to fight back against it a little bit. I think for many of us, reading the poems on the page, when you see this I, it's A-Y, and at first, at least I thought of that kind of sighing sound that you come across in Spanish language poetry, I.
Or ay caramba.
You know, and then, of course, it's some kind of pun or play with the I that is the subjective self. And the poem seems to be very hard on all these notions. The sort of sighing self is something that these poems really they don't want to deal with. They mm-hmm. posit something completely different, literally alien against that notion. So that every time in the poem you see or hear the I, it's not the one you're used to. Most of the poems we get, every two lines, there's the I, like the letter I. That doesn't occur in this poem at all. You don't see that. So who is the self being born? Who is the she who had the death in her? You have to really concentrate on this and figure out where this imaginary tribe is going to and where it came from.
Yeah, which is why I think that the physical world is interpenetrated with this consciousness, this sort of beginning consciousness, and with the consciousness of the mother's death, so that... is this her white dress me? Her rain wash me with that. Her bowl feed me empty. Mm-hmm. But the actual physical presence of the mother becomes, it inheres in physical things.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. I hadn't thought of it before, but in a way, these poems do connect with Fred Degas' poems because they are conscious at all turns of the conventional standard English language in which our literature is supposed to have been written and ought to continue if you believe in that kind of line of transmission. But these are poets who are fighting against it a little bit, saying, well, part of my own inflection doesn't sound like that. So here, she were the watcher and tender of pyres when the wet grass shined with quiet. Sort of a mixture of what we experience all the time as regular English language poetic diction with a slight change imposed upon it, yeah. So that it is not what we're used to.
And that seems to me a good example of where you can hear the poet who knows she knows the score. Mm-hmm. She were the watcher and tender of pyres when the wet grass shined with quiet. That's beautiful. Even if you don't quite pick up on what it means at first, it's very, very beautiful.
And there is real emotion. And then, I mean, at the end of the poem, when I lean to the mouth hole, and the poem ends in italics, I, mother. It makes you wonder what the relationship is, but on just a plain old ordinary day-to-day level, that I, mother, you know, it's sort of an exhalation at the end of the poem that's reassuring. You feel like there is a human connection being made here, that it's about these ancient strivings of birth and dying and living and feeding and being washed. So we know all that stuff is there, but it's ingenious in the way that it circumvents all the predictable ways of confronting yeah. these things.
And it puts them right together at the end. I and mother, they're separated by that comma.
By the comma.
And yet they're together. I and mother, sort of indistinguishable.
It's a pregnant comma.
Right. The December issue opens with three poems by the Scottish poet Roddy Lumsden, who lives in London. They're called The Young, The Beautiful, and The Damned. And we asked Roddy if these poems were part of a series.
Fitzgerald wrote a novel called The Beautiful and Damned. And that phrase, The Beautiful and The Damned, as it's become, has kind of become a cultural phrase. And I was remembering that the phrase was The Young, The Beautiful, and The Damned. And that's where the trio of poems came from. So I decided to write these three poems on youth, beauty, and fame.
His poem, The Young, seems to be in rigorous agreement with George Bernard Shaw's quip that youth is wasted on the young.
All these poems are kind of vacillations on what I really think about these issues. They're kind of devil's advocate poems, in that I do sometimes look at younger people now, I'm middle-aged, and feel jealous. On the other hand, I think there's a level of irony in this first poem. I'm not quite sure I really envy them quite as much as I'm saying.
Here's Roddy Lumsden reading The Young.
You bastards, it's all sherbet, and folly makes you laugh like mules. Chances dance off your wrists, each day ready, sprites in your bones, and spite not yet swollen, not yet set. You gather handful after miracle handful, seeing straight, reaching the lighthouse in record time, pockets brim with scimitar things. Now is not a pinpoint but a sprawling realm. Bewilderment and thrill are whip-quick twins carried on your backs, each vow new to touch and each mistake a broken biscuit. I was you, sea-robber boarding the one galleon. Roaring trees, machines without levers, easy in bowel and lung. One cartwheel over the quicksand curve of Tuesday to Tuesday, and you're gone, summering, a ship on the farthest wave.
Well, you gotta like a poem that gets your attention by starting out, "You bastards!"
Yeah. Yeah.
And certainly, if anybody ever needs to know what assonance is, this is a great example of assonance all the way through this poem, this sort of seething S sounds all the way through from beginning to end.
Chances dance off your wrists. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sprites in your bones and spite not yet swollen, not yet set.
The whole thing is just this, it just crackles with the language. There's so many different things. Bewilderment and thrill are whip-quick twins carried on your backs. You can just hear it just popping all the way through.
Yeah, it really does. It's a cartwheels from also one stanza to the next, and then where it ends is
one cartwheel over the quicksand curve of Tuesday to Tuesday, and you're gone, summering, a ship on the farthest wave.
It's funny, it sort of exhibits the energy that it attributes to them, you know, that it's lamenting not having, and yet it claims it with its own linguistic energy.
Yeah, one of the funny things is you sort of ask yourself after a while, who is the speaker, as they say in this poem?
Yeah.
It's you bastards, the young. Is it an old guy? Is it somebody stepping back? Is it some strange, impersonal part of the language that's doing the interrogation here? It's a little hard to say.
Let's hear one more by Roddy Lumsden. This one is called The Beautiful, and we asked him to set it up for us.
This poem, The Beautiful, I had in mind that situation whereby when we think about people who are exceptionally beautiful, men or women, you sometimes feel sorry for them because people never really treat them as their true selves. On the other hand, beautiful people do have an easy ride in life a lot of the time. So I was thinking about that awkwardness between those two feelings we have.
Here's Roddy Lumsden reading The Beautiful.
Into perplexity, as an itch chased round an oxter, or early man in the cave mouth watching raindrifts pour from beyond his understanding. Whether to admire the mere sensation enough, or hold out for sweeter ornament, vessels of wonder born with that our charm of symmetry. Lovely ones we ache to prize and praise, climb into and become, because they try our day-by-day significance. Some of us ugly, and most of us plain, walked past in the drowned streets, pearls of paste, salted butter, secondary colours. They drift unapproached, gazed never-selves, blunt paragons of genetic industry. We desire them, but cannot want such order. We stand, mouths open, and cannot help stammering our secrets, nailed to water.
You can read Roddy Lumsden's poems and everything you heard on this program in the December issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded and edited by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox.
The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scherer.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.